Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Welcome to the show today. I'm so excited because I have a special guest for everybody that I think a lot of people are going to be really interested in. She's the brand manager of Perky Pet Bird Feeders, which is one of the oldest and largest bird feeding companies in the world. Her name is Judy Hoysack, and she is here to help everyone learn how to bring more birds into your garden and make it a bird-friendly habitat. So welcome to the show today, Judy.
Oh, thank you, Jackie. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, I'm really excited to have you here. So go ahead and tell us a little bit more about yourself and your career.
Okay, great. Well, I work with Perky Pet. So as you mentioned, it's one of the world's largest and oldest bird feeding companies. We have a huge selection of different types of bird feeders, everything from hummingbird feeders and nectar feeders to seed feeders. And, you know, we supply, you know, most retailers that you go to when you are out there in the stores. Those are, you know, frequently one of our Perky Pet feeders. And so I came into the business because I had a real passion for, you know, products and the outdoors, and it just, you know, I was an avid birder, and it just really brought all of my interests together. So I'm, you know, really happy to be on your show. You know, I love my job. I love to talk about birds. I love to encourage other people to get out there and feed the birds. So thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm just tickled that you're here and excited to have you. And I grew up with a family of birders. I can still, like, remember, I mean, we went on tons of nature walks, like, almost every weekend. If we either went into New York City, because I grew up on Long Island, or we went to the woods, either, like, JFK out on Long Island, or Jamaica Bay, or just, there were tons of nature walks. But the one that stands out in my head the most was Hawk Mountain in Pennsylvania. Have you been there? Because you're in Pennsylvania, right?
Yes, we're actually really close to Hawk Mountain, and we've done some sponsorship events over there. It's a fantastic group, one of my very favorite places in the world. I went up there during the fall migration last year. Mm-hmm. Just really amazing. I can't, you know, I think they saw 10,000 hawks fly over in a single day. And it was one of the peak days of the season. But evidently, I think it was, it was a very sacred Native American mountain because of this really unique geography where, you know, as the hawks were flying through, they were sort of funneled in this area. And yeah, just absolutely a beautiful place.
Yeah, it's an experience that just, you just can't forget it. And I remember, like, sitting up on a rock, and, like, all the birders and my family was all on, like, this one side of this kind of, it's almost like a ledge, and there were, like, people in, like, chairs, like, sitting and staring and pointing. And I kind of went and, like, sat by myself on this big rock on kind of the other side and looked down, like, at all the Amish farms and everything. And I could just spend hours just watching the people there. And then people, every time somebody would scream hawk at 3 o'clock or hawk at 10 o'clock or something, you would look. And it's just an experience you can't forget, and just a great climb up that mountain, and just really nice. So that's, I don't know what made me think of that. I guess that you're in Pennsylvania.
So
today we're going to talk about bringing birds to our gardens. So but let's, you know, I always like to start at the show by learning a little bit about you and, like, your very first gardening experience. You know, like, how old were you? Were you a kid, an adult? Who were you with? What'd you grow? Like, tell us about your very first. Are you from Pennsylvania?
I'm not. And actually, I grew up originally, I'm from North Carolina. And, you know, I grew up in the suburbs and was very ambivalent about the outdoors. Everyone had a yard and a garden. And I was living in Brooklyn. I went to New York after I graduated my undergrad. And I was just starved for nature. And I just, you know, was obsessed with, like, growing more and more plants inside my home until eventually it was looking quite like a jungle. And I actually went and studied product design in New York. And I was completely obsessed with, you know, this idea of my starvation for nature. And I focused my master's thesis on products that encouraged people to interact with nature in different ways. So I created this whole kooky furniture line that, you know, allowed you to grow vegetables in your coffee table, and, you know, room dividers that had beans, and, you know,
just make
these wacky things. So, you know, it was really at that point that, you know, I really which, you know, I was doing like weird hydroponic experiments inside, like just doing really just fun experiments and, you know, just really wishing that I'd had some real outdoor space to get out there and garden. But since I didn't, I was just, you know, anywhere I could possibly try to grow some vegetables I was trying. Now I live out more and, you know, in rural Pennsylvania and I have a little yard and, you know, I'm actually out there in the dirt planting things. And so, you know, it's very fulfilling. It's, you know, something that's really missing out of my life for a long time, I think. And I find that it just, you know, is really essential to my character.
Awesome. All right. Well, that was a great introduction. And just what a journey that you've had. So all the way to Brooklyn and then ending up in Pennsylvania. And there, I have to say, there are some pretty nice parks and some really nice trees in Brooklyn. Like my very first college experience, I went to Pratt Institute in Brooklyn.
Pratt Institute.
You did? Is that, I was going to ask you, where did you end up going for product design?
Yeah, I was at Pratt actually.
So I would love to sit and they had the greatest, I thought, the quad there. And just sitting under those trees. And I practically got kicked out because I was a photography major. And they were like, if you take one more picture of a tree, you're going to like fail this class. Like, we want to see something else. And I was like, but they're all different trees.
Right. Oh, cool. Wow.
So,
coincidence.
Yeah, totally. But yeah, there's definitely some beautiful places there. But I could, yes. You know, whenever I go to New York, I get a little crazy. It's a nice place to visit, but.
Yes, yes, absolutely. The Brooklyn Botanic Garden also, just what an
experience. Yes, yes, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, do you want to share what like organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening means to you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I am lucky to live in rural Pennsylvania. We have, you know, just Amish farms and, you know, very, very many local farms in this area, which are very, very fortunate. Just about everything I eat comes from Lancaster County. And, you know, I try to really get outside of that, you know, mass produced food system myself because, you know, I prefer the taste and freshness of things that are local. I mean, when you grow them yourself, though, you really get so much more. I mean, you can eat a bean that was, you know, growing like 10 seconds ago. And, you know, that's just so much more exciting and fulfilling than even something that perhaps was picked yesterday, which is just, you know, so much better than most people are, you know, even fortunate enough to enjoy. But yeah, it's, you know, and in this area too, it's not necessarily that a lot of the farms are certified organic. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, they say that they don't spray or they're not certified organic, but, you know, they're using, you know, minimal amounts of pesticides and, you know, keeping things as natural as possible because that's the old way of doing it, but not are not necessarily have gone through that certification, which is, you know, which is fine with me as long as, you know, you're doing things in a more pesticide-free way. I'm more than happy to participate in that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So do you want to tell us a little bit about how to attract birds to the garden?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, one of the great things about having a little garden is being able to enjoy the wildlife and the bees and the butterflies and the birds that come out there. And, you know, I think a lot of times that, you know, you can put a lot of different plants and things there that will naturally attract them. And that's really fun and easy to do, but sometimes you want to do a little bit more than that. And one of the great ways of doing that is by adding bird feeders to the yard and giving them another natural food source. So, you know, there's lots of different types of bird feeders that you can get, but, you know, it's a pretty simple concept. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to get overly complicated, you know, seed feeders to attract the seed eating birds, nectar feeders to attract hummingbirds and different orioles and birds like that. They also really are attracted to water in the yard. You always want to provide a water source. They're attracted to moving water too. So not necessarily a stagnant bird bath, but, you know, I have a little contraption they call a wiggler in there. So they're attracted to the moving water. If you have a fountain, the sound attracts them also. And, you know, providing them a bit of shelter, you know, making sure you have some shrubs or bushes, or even if you have down trees and branches, just giving them a place of refuge in case some, you know, bigger birds or predators happen to fly by.
Okay. So lots of things I wanted to ask you. And I did do a little research this morning on the website and saw the different feeders. And actually, I learned a lot from your FAQ pages on the website about different things you can do to attract birds. And also, you know, a big question I hear a lot is about how to get rid of the squirrels or keep squirrels out of their bird feeders. So there were some good tidbits there. But do you want to explain to listeners, like, what the difference between, like, a seed feeder and a nectar feeder is?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we have a few different categories of feeders that, you know, we consider. And, you know, basically the differentiation is seed feeders versus nectar feeders. And, you know, an easy overview of that is, yes, a seed feeder holds bird seed. And so, you know, there's, gosh, dozens of different kinds of bird seed that you could put in a feeder and, you know, a dozen different styles and shapes of feeders that you could possibly put it in. And so one of the ones that is most common or, you know, typical that people might be familiar with would just be your standard tube feeder. It's a cylinder. It has several ports coming out of the side, you know, a lid and just a way to hook it to a tree. And, you know, that's a really easy entry into bird feeding. You know, they've come in, you know, a wide range of price points and, you know, materials and fanciness, but, you know, a simple tube feeder is a great place to start. If you're curious about what kind of seeds to put in there, you know, you go in there and they have, you know, different bags of, you know, sometimes it looks like trail mix or look, you know, you can see just a huge variety of different types of bird seed. And so it can be quite intimidating. But a good place to start is just look for a bag of just black oil sunflower seed. It's, you know, not expensive. It's one of the most widely enjoyed seeds of any birds. Most birds will really readily enjoy that seed in particular. It's like a high fat and protein content, which is really what they're looking for. So, you know, don't necessarily just go for the very cheapest seeds you can find. A lot of times they're in there that you get a lot of filler and the birds are just going to end up kicking it out of the feeder and making a big mess. So going with something, you know, like just a good mid-range black oil sunflower seed is your best choice. And you're going to attract, you know, the widest variety of birds with, you know, with a single type of seed like that.
That's what we use here the most. We just like buy huge bags of them. Like I think they're 32 pound bags, I want to say, every winter, several of them. And then we get tons of birds, just all sorts of different like grosbeaks and pine siskins. Is that what they are?
Yeah.
And, just tons of different, I can't even remember all the names of all the different birds we get, but
fantastic.
And they chickadees and nuthatches especially are just always here. And it's just so nice to look at them eating them. And so then I was kind of told you and my listeners know, like my goal for this year is to plant 750 sunflowers. And then I'm hoping to harvest 2,000 blooms because I bought this book called The Flower Farmer. And my first year I planted 75 sunflower seeds and got 200 blooms. So this year I'm multiplying that by 10 and hoping because like, well, eventually if I take them to market, so I just, this year I want to see, can I consistently harvest that many flowers like all through August and September, maybe July. I can't imagine I'm going to actually have blooms coming in July, but some I planted on Earth Day back in April are almost a foot tall. I was looking at this morning, but 300 of the seeds that I planted, Mike was like, so I bring home all these packets of seeds from Home Depot one day. I'm like, look, they had organic seeds and they had, you know, all sorts of different sunflowers. And, you know, I tried these Martha Stewart organic ones and Burpee's organic ones. And he's like, why don't you just plant the sunflower seeds that we buy from the bird feed store for the birds? So 300 of the seeds that I planted are those black, what did you call them again? The black oil.
Black oil
sunflower seeds. And they're coming up, so they're doing good. So we'll see how that goes, just planting those in the ground. So yeah. I'm hoping, if nothing else, I'll have tons of bird seed, and we won't have to buy that next winter.
That's great. Yeah, you do get a lot of volunteers when you're feeding with the black oil sunflower seeds. And and that's a common question that I get is, you know, actually, you know, how do I prevent all of these seeds from sprouting underneath my feeder or around my yard?
I saw that, but why do people worry? What are people worried about that for?
Well, I have a little, you know, I live in tiny downtown Lancaster, and I have only a little pocket, what I call a pocket garden, you know, the row houses. And so it's a very small area, and unlike, you know, a nice Montana farm. So so my back garden is, you know, really only 10 feet by 20 feet. So I have a lot of birdseed everywhere, and I'm trying to do a lot in that small space, including have a little patio and grow a few vegetables and some flowers and a little, you know, 4x8 spot of grass for my dog to roll around in. So what happens is underneath the feeders, you get a huge amount of seeds and sprouts coming up underneath the feeders. And it's a common complaint for those that have it located, you know, just off their patio or, you know, in a place where, you know, it's not really desirable. So I switched, actually, this past year, I've switched to a sunflower heart. So it's like pre-shelled mix.
Oh.
So they have those. They sometimes call them no-waste mixes, but it's pre-shelled, so there's nothing in there. You know, once the husk is gone, there's nothing in there to sprout. And there's also some organic pre-emergent types of weed controllers. Like we have one that I know about called it's called a Safer Concern Weed Prevention Plus. It's all organic, OMRI listed. And I think they make it out of a corn gluten, so it reacts with the seeds and prevents them from sprouting in the first place. And it's great to use in the garden because, you know, it's safe for pets or children or birds. If the birds eat it, it totally doesn't, you know, affect them in any way. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, another great way to, you know, keep your bird feeding area neat.
Okay. The other thing I think we have, well, one of our bird feeders is in our garden area, but most of our bird feeders are out where the deer are, and maybe the deer just eat all those leftover seeds, so we don't have that problem. Okay, so good. So there's a option for other people. So, let's see. What else was I going to ask you about? So then, what would you recommend for people to do to attract more birds into their garden?
Well, let's see. I would say we talked a little bit about the seed feeding birds, but maybe we could talk a little bit about hummingbirds in particular.
The nectar feeders too. Because yeah. I think some people probably have questions about, like, do I have to put the sugar in the water for the hummingbirds? Is that what the nectar, like you would put, make like a sugar water mix?
Yeah, it's just, you know, sugar water, and you just put it in a, you know, plastic or glass container with some, we call ports, where the hummingbirds can come, and they can either have perches or not have perches. But hummingbirds, I mean, they're really amazing, amazing birds. And, you know, their wings beat like 80 times a second. And, you know, they fly these huge distances. And they're, you know, they use up so much energy so fast that basically, like, they have to keep eating constantly or they'll just, like, starve to death and die, which is sometimes how I feel during the day. But not quite as bad as a hummingbird. I mean, in fact, even, like, to go to sleep for the night, they have to go almost into this hibernation state because they can't sleep long enough or they'll starve. So they have to, you know, even hibernate during the night. So they're constantly, and they do eat a lot of bugs and insects and things like that for protein, but they drink flower nectar for, you know, the carbohydrate energy. And so if you put up these nectar feeders, which are the sugar water feeders, they come and, you know, they get that and they love it. So, you know, hanging up the nectar feeders is a really fun way. The feeders don't have to be red. The nectar doesn't have to be red. As long as it's, you know, some nice bright color, if it's your first time hanging one, if you're trying to attract them to your garden, you know, they'll pretty much notice any bright color. They usually remember the location more than they have a color preference. So once you get them attracted to the yard, they'll actually come back. You'll see the same ones visiting every year because they just have this, like, amazing memory for these flower patches. And, you know, they'll actually, you know, as they're migrating, most of the species are migratory. So as they're migrating, you know, up from Central and South America up to Canada, the same birds will, you know, stop at the same places all along through that journey. So they're pretty incredible.
That is amazing that they would remember which, you know, homes to go to and where they saw certain flowers and got good, you know, protein or, like you were saying, carbohydrates and things. How about, are there plants that attract hummingbirds too?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because I mean that's their, their more natural food source. So anything, brightly colored flowers, especially like more trumpet shaped flowers, azaleas are one of their favorites. Butterfly bushes, they really like lantana. Bee balm, coral bells, fuchsia, lots of different species of salvia. So I mean that's, one of the easiest ways to bring them initially, because if they see a backyard full of, all these beautiful nectar filled flowers, that'll definitely attract their attention. And you just want to make sure, as you're doing this, be careful about what you're, I know most of your listeners are, concerned with organic products and, not using a lot of, pesticides and chemicals back there. But if you are doing this to attract wildlife, you want to be just extra careful because, anything that you're putting out there in the garden, it's possible that, these birds could be ingesting and, you wouldn't want to put anything out there that, if you have these birds back there that you wouldn't want to eat yourself. And you're a lot tinier, a lot larger than a tiny little hummingbird. So just, be super conscious of that when you are attracting wildlife.
Cool. I like that. And what about, like, I don't know, we've been having a problem with our neighbors because we just got bees and we saw our neighbors spraying the road the other day already. And we're thinking, and not only that, they planted like all these wildflowers on their property. And we're thinking, the bees are going to go down there. They're going to be attracted to your wildflowers that you planted. And now you're spraying. I'm just a little frustrated with my neighbors right now. So I don't know if you have any suggestions for how to deal with people around your neighborhood.
I actually had a neighbor last year that we have a shared fence, and he sprayed Roundup right up to the side of his fence and killed everything I had that was planted up against my side of that fence. So,
No.
yeah, I was pretty upset.
Oh.
Yeah, so I don't know what to do about those neighbors. Just mine moved, so that was lucky.
Oh. You know what? You mentioned that I was going to ask you, and I did read a little bit about this on your thing, but they always sell the red hummingbird feeders, or people put the red dye, but did you say you don't need to do that? Is that it just if it's a bright color?
Yes, absolutely. As long as the feeder, if it's the first time you're hanging a feeder, we generally recommend, that you choose a brighter color feeder because, the birds are attracted to those bright colors because it looks like, the bright colors of the garden. But, even after it's in place, like we sell clear glass feeders and, you can just put your clear sugar water in there. And, and as I was mentioning, they just remember the position in particular.
Okay. What was I gonna say? And then I saw you had like those cool mason jar things. But I've even seen people put like just a plate out with water, but you would have to fill that constantly, I would think.
I wonder if that when they were putting out a plate of water, or if it was, that was the sugar water for the birds. Because honestly, I think if you put out a plate of water without the feeder, sorry, a plate of sugar water without the feeder, you're going to have a lot of problems with pests. And that's actually, I could get into that a bit. Many times we get questions from people, how do we keep the ants away from the feeder? How do you keep bees away? So we have a few products for keeping the ants away. So we have these we call ant moats, and you fill them with water and you hang it above your hummingbird feeder, and it keeps like the ants kind of like can't swim, so they can't cross across the moat to get down to the nectar. We also have feeders with bee guards, which are basically like a little plastic guard that goes over the port, and it extends the distance of the port to the nectar. So say a bird's tongue, a hummingbird's tongue is say like it's like a couple inches long, and a bee's tongue is only like 8 to 10 millimeters long. So if you're increasing, the amount of distance between the access point and the level of the sugar water, you can do a bit to attract bees. We also recommend even hanging up just another feeder with a higher concentration of sugar nectar. So you may just add more sugar when you're making it, and the bees will be attracted to that even more. But the hummingbirds feel like that's like a little bit too sweet. So hopefully, if you hang that in a different part of your garden, All the bees will, you know, flock to that one, and then the hummingbirds will stay at your regular concentration feeders.
Okay, cool. That's a good, I like that idea there. Especially something to feed the bees. I haven't really thought about that, putting something out to feed the bees. I wonder if, no, I don't know. I'm sure Mike has that figured out. We do fill like water buckets for them. And then like, we have this kind of like creek that we've been working on building sort of type of thing. That's going to like recycle water one of these days. We get a pump and get everything working right. But so he's just been kind of like putting the hose on it right now and just kind of watering the rocks sort of. So there's like damp rocks and like these itty bitty miniature tiny puddles in a place that they go there a lot when he turns that water on. Mm. I've noticed. So, what about like, when do you hang your hummingbird feeder up? Is there like a certain time of year, or can you just put that up anytime?
Well, in most areas of the country, we would only have migratory species of hummingbirds. There's, you know, a few places and around the Pacific Northwest and California, even into British Columbia, that have hummingbirds that overwinter. But for the most part, we have about 13 different species in the United States, and they're migratory. So they come up in the spring from Central South America. They travel as it gets warmer. They travel and they follow the flowers as they're migrating, because, you know, they need to keep eating, right? Because like, if they don't eat for like 5 minutes, they'll just keel over. So they're following these flowers up, and then, you know, they go, you know, up north all the way into Canada. You know, they stay there in the summer and they have their babies and they come back down. So, you know, every year, because it depends on the weather a lot, and it depends a lot on, you know, if it's a warm spring, you might get the hummingbirds a little bit earlier. So, you know, early spring, you start hanging up your hummingbirds and hummingbird feeders. I actually have on our website, birdfeeders.com, we have a migration map. So you can actually check, and, you know, as people start seeing hummingbirds in their area, they'll post on the map. And, you know, once there's sightings, you know, you can kind of, you know, see, okay, look, you know, each week they go, you know, up another 100 miles. So it's really kind of fun to watch, as, you know, you see on the map, like they're getting closer. And then, you know, leave it up through the summer. Don't worry about taking it down. You know, a lot of questions we get are, you know, well, should I take it down so that, you know, because will the birds stay over the winter and they won't migrate like they need to if I leave my hummingbird feeder up? No, it's like really instinctual, and those, you know, you're not going to prevent them from migrating if you leave your hummingbird feeder up a week too long. And if you're in one of those places that you have them that overwinter, you know, definitely leave it up all year round. If it's cold, you may want to bring it in at night because they're going to get frozen through the night. But, you know, usually if you hang it up back up during the day, you'll continue to see them all winter long.
Wow. That must be down south, like in Texas or somewhere, huh?
Well, it actually, surprisingly, is, you know, areas also up in the Pacific Northwest where it's more temperate.
Oh,
what? But also, yeah, also in the Gulf area, you'll see some too. And in fact, some species just like kind of just don't make it all the way down to South America. Like some individuals won't make it all the way down, even though most of their species is going, you know, all the way down to Central and South America. They kind of just are like, you know what, maybe Southern Texas is good enough for me.
Wow. Have you seen that movie, The Big Year, with like Steve Martin and Owen Wilson and... what's that, Black, Jack Black guy? That movie's fun. And they all those birds down when the storm hits down in the Gulf of Mexico, they all head down there. It's kind of cool. Okay. How about, you kind of like, we hit on, like, what steps can you make sure to make sure your garden's safe for birds?
Yes. So, yeah, I hit on a few of these tips, but you know, one of the main things is be careful what you're putting, you know, on your plants and on the ground and, you know, on your lawn and in your garden. So just make sure you're putting nice, safe things if you're putting anything out there, because, you know, you want your birds to stay safe. Another thing is cats. That's actually, you know, a lot of times if you have outside cats, you know, we hear a lot of stories like that. So, you know, put a bell on your cat to just give the birds a heads up, because there's, you know, this, I have a cat, he's pretty fast, he's sneaky, he, you know, he likes to, you know what they do. So, mm-hmm. and sometimes you'll have a neighbor too, the whole neighbor thing too. If you have neighbors out there with cats, like, and their cats don't have bells, like, you know, see if you can get your neighbor to put a bell on their cat too. Window strikes is another big one. That's when windows, you know, look really reflective for the birds. And so they don't actually, I mean, they don't understand glass, right? So mm-hmm. they're birds, they see the reflection in the window, and, you know, it can either just look like a, you know, a nice open place to fly if it's just reflecting the sky, and they just fly right in and smack themselves and can knock themselves out or kill themselves. Or sometimes they'll see their own reflection. And this is, you know, particularly with territorial males, they'll see the reflection in there and they'll actually think it's, you know, another bird, mm-hmm. and we'll try to fight it, and we'll just keep, like, repeatedly, we hear stories like this a lot, and I've experienced it, repeatedly flying into the window, trying to attack its reflection, and, you know, will also knock itself out, stun itself, and sometimes even, you know, even it'll die. So that's pretty sad. So what you can do is you can put up these window decals. They make, lots of different companies make them. They look, they're clear, but I think they're ultraviolet. So, you know, they're pretty undiscernible to humans, but it really breaks up the reflection for the birds. And so it's really useful to prevent those window strikes.
Oh, I didn't know they had things like that. So it's basically like clear, but so it doesn't, like, the person whose window it is, it doesn't bother them. I was right. thinking like decals, like, you know, stickers or something with rainbows, or, you know.
I mean, yeah, you could do that too.
Things on them. Cool. How about your garden? Like, do you want to tell us about something that grew well in your garden this year at all? Or last year, last season?
Well, okay, that's fun. I will talk about my garden all day long, of course.
Okay, cool.
So one thing that I really got excited about last year, and okay, so I was saying I grew up in the South, and so, I'm not, like, my family isn't from, doesn't have deep roots in the South, but, mm-hmm. you know, I do have friends that have a lot of, ties to the South. And so they eat these, like, different, all these different types of peas and beans in the South, right? Like, you know, like green peas, like little, you know, mm-hmm. green peas. Well, there's so many peas beyond that. And they, you know, things like the most common one that we would know of would be lima beans, but there's all these other varieties too. And so, I grew a Native American bean, and it was like a long bean, like a pole bean.
Mm-hmm.
And you could eat them fresh or you could dry them. And I believe it was called, Eye of the Goat bean. So it was this heirloom bean, and it was like the most delicious bean I've ever had in my life. So I was eating them fresh and, you know, just lightly boiled with some olive oil and garlic. Mm-hmm. And then I also dried a lot of them and, you know, was just able to eat my own dried bean. You know, I dried them in the shells, and then I, you know, shelled them after they were dried and kept a jar of them around and then ate them through the winter. So that was like the highlight of my last year's garden. So I'm doing them again this year. Still early, but
wow,
exciting.
I had a guest on from Kentucky, Joyce Pinson, and she talked about a lot of different beans and peas, but that really, I didn't realize that there were that many. Cool. Eye of the Goat. That sounds interesting. And they were yummy, huh?
Yes, highly recommend it.
And how ambitious to grow beans and then dry them and can them already. That's something I've never tried to do. How about, is there something you're excited to try this year that you haven't done before? Something new or different?
I'm doing, so it's a little bit, also a little bit obscure, but I'm, so I have a really strong love of sushi.
Huh?
And so sometimes when you get a sushi plate, you get this little green leaf there. I don't know if you recall this. And it's this Japanese herb called shiso. And so I've just been completely obsessed with this leaf lately. And so I ordered some of these seeds. They have green ones. It's also actually, it's grown in the United States commonly as an ornamental called perilla. That name is familiar?
So not to me, but
Sometimes I haven't been able to find it, but I've heard some people are like, oh, that's perilla. So I don't know.
Right. And just quickly, how do you spell that, the herb that you grew?
Perilla, I think, is the more like American name for it. And then it's in Japanese, the name is shiso, shiso.
Okay, cool.
And so I made like pestos out of it. And, you know, you can eat it with sashimi, or, you know, you can make pickles. So I've been doing a lot of fun things with this new herb.
Nice. Now, do you grow that like outside in the garden or in a pot in your kitchen, or where do you grow that?
In the garden. I started from seed and just those little jiffy pots, and then I put it, you know, planted it into the main part of my garden.
Cool. How about, do you want to tell us about something that didn't work so well last year? Maybe didn't go as, like,
You know what I did? I got overly ambitious, and I planted so many vegetables on, because, you know, when you first start planting, mm-hmm. and everything's tiny, and, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, oh, I have plenty of room here. And okra just intertwined with my roses, and, you know, the eggplant was completely dwarfing my hydrangeas, because I mix everything all up together because my space is so small. So this year I had to learn to, you know, hold back a little bit.
Okay, cool. What's your least favorite activity to do in the garden? Is there something that you have to, like, just force yourself to get out there and do?
Well, no, I love every bit of it.
Okay. How about your favorite activity?
Weeding. Okay. Isn't that crazy?
Tell us about weeding that you, what part of weeding that you like to do in your little garden.
I just sit there and weed for hours. I just find it such a, like, you know, there's a very peaceful meditative activity. I just will sit there and just pick out every last weed out of the whole garden. I love it.
Nice. All right. You are going to inspire people, I can tell, to get out there. How about any gardening advice that you've received that you would say is, like, you know, super important or something that really worked well for you?
Just, you know what? Don't be afraid to experiment. And then if something doesn't work and it dies, just, you know, don't be discouraged. Just, you know, keep trying.
Cool. How about, do you have a favorite tool that you like to use? Like, if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without? Got a tool like that?
Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, I like my little gardening knee pads a lot. I have the ones that look like they strap on. Mm-hmm. So as you're moving around the garden and weeding, you know, you don't have to worry about moving the little, like, the squishy pad for your knees. You can just kind of crawl all around there. So I think those are my favorite. And plus they, you know, they make you look kind of funny, which I like too.
Cool. How about tips for, like, preserving food or making food last at all? Anything you were talking about, like, making basil or the pesto out of that cool herb? Got any? And what was the other thing you were telling me that I thought was so interesting? Oh, dehydrating the beans.
Oh, yes. Well, I just dried them. I just, you know, picked them in the shells. I left them to dry on the vine for quite a while until they kind of get brown. And then you pick them. And then when they're totally dry, you know, I shell them out of the pods and then just put them in a jar. And they just lasted in my cupboard all winter like that. But I did get into, you know, the whole, like, you know, canning thing last summer. I didn't get a pressure canner. I just tried to learn the water bath canning. Mm-hmm. But and I did freeze some things. But I kind of decided, you know, I live in, you know, an area where probably I'm not going to have to worry about losing that much electricity during the winter. And I really just like the taste of the fresher preserved things. So I think I'm going to get away from the water bath canning and just freeze more vegetables once I have too many, or, you know, freeze the pestos. And because I find that once you have to add the amount of acid to preserve it, it changes the flavor so much. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm going to be just doing some more freezing. And then I like more of the fermented pickling. So that's my next endeavor.
I was listening to a fellow podcaster last night talk about fermented pickles. And she was saying that those are the healthiest kind. They're just more time intensive. But she said they're pretty basic. She said it sounded like they weren't very difficult to make, but just just a little more time intensive, but certainly the healthiest way to make pickles. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah,
she's like this canning expert that is on that Growing Greener world, and she just started a podcast about homesteading, I think.
Ooh, cool.
Like it's called like the Homestead Without the Farm or something podcast. I'll put the link in the show notes so people can check her out. She had a really interesting show. Got any special techniques for cooking any kind of weird or unusual food? You told us about that one shishu. Anything else? I mean, that was pretty good right there.
Yeah, maybe that's my good one.
Or a favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden?
That's a stumper, not sure. Nothing offhand. I mean, I just, you know, I love fresh things. I love vegetables. I love, you know, I just find if you have just fresh, delicious things, you don't really have to do that much to it.
Mm-hmm. How about a favorite internet resource?
You know, I've been on my Facebook feed or whatever. I liked the Rodale site recently. Are you familiar with them? They have like the Organic Gardening magazine and the publishing company. Mm-hmm. I find that they have like every single one of their posts, and they post really frequently on Facebook. Every single one of them is like really, really fascinating. So I've been looking at them a lot lately. Just all kinds of just great gardening tips and, you know, recipes and resources.
Well, they just kind of went through a I don't know if it's a rebranding or like they're not doing organic gardening. It's called Organic Life now, their magazine. And so they're kind of going through this whole new phase. So maybe that's part of why.
Oh, perhaps. So cool. Yeah, it's pretty good.
All right. I like that. That's great. And I love Facebook. So I'm glad that you brought that up. So how about a favorite reading material? Like, is there a book or a magazine that you really like? Or a blog?
Oh gosh, that's hard to pick one.
Maybe one on birds at all?
I could talk, you know, I probably should talk about birds a little bit here. I do get carried away when I talk about gardening because they are my two passions, but I would like to definitely give a plug to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology website as a birding resource. Yeah, they have, just one of just the most wonderful, well-developed websites for birding that, you know, we like to put a lot of information on our website, birdfeeders.com, but, and it truly is the resource. They have allaboutbirds.org, and so it's just a wealth of information. Most of the time people are, you know, looking for information. They're often interested in what kind of bird did I see in my garden, and, you know, they have huge, like they have a new app that just launched this week through their Merlin ID. It's like Merlin, like the wizard or the bird Merlin. Mm-hmm. But you can actually upload a picture of a bird now and it will tell you what it is. It's like the coolest thing ever.
Cool.
You can identify it from a photograph. I mean, there's lots of really cool apps that I use for bird identification. And of course, you know, field guides to, you know, Peterson's Guide, Sibley's and whatnot.
I don't know about any of this. Tell us more.
Oh, cool. Okay. Well, so.
And I love my iPhone almost as much as I love Facebook. Probably maybe awesome. More.
So once you get into, you know, having your garden and then, all, you know, you've got these birds coming and you're like, what is that bird? You know, it's like really cool, but I have no idea what it is. And so then you're going to, you know, get out there and try to figure out what kind of bird you've got. I started off with, you know, a Peterson's field guide to birds. And, you know, it's to this day, you know, one of my favorite resources. Mm-hmm. And so that one is nice. It has illustrations and it tells you, you know, what range, you know, are you in the right place to see that kind of bird? Mm-hmm. Is it the right time of year? And so, you know, and that covers, you know, basically every bird you'll see in your area. And I just sit there reading it all day long. But, you know, they have a lot of great technological resources too. So I have apps on my phone also when I'm out birding or just in the garden and I see a bird that I don't recognize. The one that I use most commonly is iBird, just like a lowercase I-B-I-R-D. But Cornell has some great ones. They have ones particularly for backyard birding too. Their Merlin app is really, really good for that, especially if you're newer to birding. But as I was just saying about this new software where you actually upload the picture and it will tell you what kind of birds. I haven't tested it. It's just been out for a couple of days, but it's just really phenomenal. And I think I heard about a team in the United Kingdom that was working on a program that you could like record the song and play it for this software
Oh, wow.
what bird was singing too. So it's like Shazam for birds. So it's pretty cool.
Awesome. You know, I just went to Glacier Park the other day with some friends, and they were asking that very question. They were like, "Do you know what kind of bird this is that's making the song?" And I was like, "I have no idea." And then the other thing that's got me curious, just kind of along the same line, is we were looking at tons of wildflowers and trying to identify wildflowers. So I wonder if there's like, I'm gonna have to look and see if there's a wildflower identifying app that you can do that same thing with. Gosh, has technology not come? Like, what a dream. Put the bird in, upload the bird, and it will identify it. How crazy.
Pretty awesome. I think that there is a wildflower app.
Yeah, I'll bet that there probably is if there's a bird one. I'll bet. I'll have to look that up. My bird book that I have is an Audubon Handbook of Western Birds, and that has been the key book for me. I've used this bird book ever since I moved to Montana. It's just been a big, and it answers a lot of those questions, like could you see it here? And the thing I like about it, it's got a nice for size, it's kind of like has a nice diagram so you can easily see, is this bird, you know, is this big enough to be that bird? You can tell that, to me, that's like one of the big things right away. You can tell if it's like just got a bar, two bars, it should be a really tiny bird, like a hummingbird. And if it's like six bars, you know, it's going to be bigger, like a duck or a goose or something. So I like that part of it. Okay, how about, what else did you want to share about birds? Like,
Squirrels, as we were saying, we talked a little bit about squirrels. People always want to know, what can I do about all of the squirrels at my bird feeders? I mean, we have lots of different tips on, if you have a squirrel problem. The very first thing of all that you want to do is make sure you're just hanging it correctly. You want to make sure that you're hanging it, and this is pretty tricky, especially if you have a little tiny yard like I do, but hang it 10 feet away from any tree or fence or point that they can jump, and at least 6 feet off the ground. So, if you have a smaller space, that can be a little bit difficult. So we have some other tips you can try. There's baffles, which is basically like a plastic dome that hangs over the top of the feeder, so that if they try to jump from the top, they land on this wobbly plastic dome and hopefully topple over. There's also a type of baffle that you can put on the pole. Like if you have a shepherd's hook, you can actually, attach this dome on the pole to keep them from crawling up underneath.
What's a shepherd's hook? Wait.
Oh, a shepherd's hook would be like, imagine like, your like cartoon image of a shepherd in your mind holding that like kind of crook shaped cane
Oh,
stick
we have one
thing.
of those.
Yes, there you go.
Just didn't know what it was called. Cool.
Yes.
And so then if you're not hanging from a tree, then what would you be hanging like from? I'm trying to picture what it would be hanging from if it wasn't hanging from a tree.
Well, the shepherd's hook, or it would might be there's actually special like bird feeder poles that you can buy at the wherever. So it's just kind of like a a black metal wrought iron pole with some arms sticking out of the side. And that's another common way that people are hanging the feeders. And so if those things aren't working for you, we also have what we call squirrel proof feeders. And there's a lot of different ways that they may work. One of the common ways is like weight activation. So it might have, an inner and an outer cage around the tube. So as they jump on it, there's springs, and so they jump on it and the cage slides down and they're not able to access the seed. There's also a seed in particular too that's common that squirrels don't tend to prefer. I'm not saying it's a 100%, but it tends to discourage them somewhat. It's safflower.
Oh.
And so it's a little more bitter, I understand. And so I've been using that sometimes too. And I think I do get less squirrels with the safflower than without.
Oh, okay. We don't get a lot of squirrels, I think, at our feeders because we have dogs and cats. They kind of keep those at those runoff pretty well. But I know my mom has a big problem with squirrels. So, and in Montana, we have ours are kind of smaller. They're more like a chipmunk size type.
Oh, that's not quite as bad. Yes, I think people that do have squirrel problems get very passionate about their squirrel problems.
My mom's biggest squirrel problem is they eat her pumpkins in the fall when she tries to decorate for Halloween. They're
To
always
me
eating
too.
pumpkins.
Yeah, they'll eat their faces off.
All right. Anything else that I've forgotten that you wanted to mention about the birds in the backyard?
I think we covered a lot here today.
Yeah, we're almost at an hour, actually.
I
So, all right. Are you ready for my final question?
Sure.
Okay. So, Judy, if there was one change that you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either in your local area or on a national or global scale?
Wow, that is a fantastic question. The
Oh,
one,
thanks.
yeah, wow, that's a good one and totally unanticipated. You know what? I think I would like to see people get outside their areas a little bit more, and I think what happens is that we lose empathy in people because, most people aren't bad or selfish, but you just get caught up in your life and you don't see your m impact and you don't understand how much more of the world that there is. So I don't know if there's just, I mean, and probably the internet is a great way for people to have already gotten more connected, but just, to understand, yeah, you are like this one little part of, this really big system, and and that everything you do and matters, and that we all matter.
Nice. I like that. I'm constantly telling people, like my friends that don't vote, I'm like, look, you're a woman, you're born in the United States of America, you have the right to vote. And when you vote, you're not just voting for yourself, you're voting for hundreds of millions of people around the world that don't have the option to vote, and that Americans, by just our activities, our shopping activities, our transportation activities, just the daily things we do affect people in other places in the world. And to not, sorry, I probably should get off my pulpit, but just a lot of what you said reminded me of that. And just kind of like, you have to think about it. It's not just, there's a bigger world out there, and in all of our steps, like the people in the Maldives that are, suffering from climate change more than anybody, what they would probably do to get a chance to vote in the United States. And I just think about that a lot. Anyway, sorry. How about an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
Oh my gosh. Okay. I was like about to bust out with something really great and then I had nothing. Oh wow. To get out there.
Or to attract the birds into their yard.
So, one thing that I find among those that are new to bird feeding is that, the day that you see a new visitor come to your garden is, like the most exciting thing that's happened to you all day. You see this new bird at your feeder and, you go out there and you tell your friends and you're trying to figure out what it is. And, by inviting this wildlife into your garden and into your home and into your life, you're really just, you don't really understand it, but you're adding a lot of excitement that wasn't really there to just your everyday living.
Nice. I like that. That's perfect. Well, Judy, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your expertise. And just, I think listeners are really going to like this episode because I think people are interested in birds and how to, grow different plants, but also how to attract different, birds and insects and bees even to their yard. And especially hummingbirds are always so fun to see. And usually you can hear them. I think that's the cool part, right? That you can hear them before they come, and then you look up and you're like, wow, look at that. Do you want to tell listeners how to connect with you? If they have any questions, can they reach out to you?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Just visit our website,
Okay.
birdfeeders.com.
Well, thanks so much for coming on today.
Okay, thank you so much for having me, Jackie. It was a pleasure.
Yeah. Hey everyone, Jackie Beyer here, host of the Organic Gardener Podcast. I just wanted to encourage everyone, if you haven't already signed up for our 2015 Gardening Challenge, to go ahead and do it. We'll probably keep it open through the end of June and then probably close it down about July 1st. Surely everybody will have everything in the garden by then. I know I'm always looking at the nurseries for flowers to still plant petunias and things by then, but you know, that's me. They're almost always sold out. So think about what vegetable, what fruit, what flower do you want to plant enough of for a whole season? And we're just saying like 2 or 3 months. You know, do you want enough carrots to feed your kids or enough broccoli to, you know, feed your household for the summer or enough apples on a fruit tree? What would you plant that would feed your household for one season this year? We're just going one short season, 2, 3 months. If you pick lettuce, I think if you planted it now, you'd still have enough for a good 2 months. So think, you know, are we gonna eat a salad every night? How many heads of lettuce? What would that cost us? And then, you know, are you gonna buy a pack of seeds? And then get it in the ground and let us know. You can, I got an even easier Gmail account, so it's just orgpodcast@gmail.com. ORG for organic, orgpodcast@gmail.com. You can email me, you can go to our website. I think you can even go to the organicgardenerpodcast.com now. But just in case, awesomemontana.com will get you there. AWESOMEMONTANA. That's just my website with, you know, it's got my artist links and some other things up there. And then go to Mike's Green Garden, the Organic Gardener Podcast, right on top. Should say 2015 Garden Challenge. So go to the awesomemontana.com website or email me at orgpodcast@gmail.com. orgpodcast@gmail.com. Tell us, you know, just your first name or username. Your how many people are in your household? What fruit, vegetable, or flower are you gonna grow? Like, what part of the country do you live in? You know, are you what state or are you out of the state, somewhere else in another country? How cool would that be? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. Any feedback about the podcast? I'm so glad you enjoy it. The downloads are just amazing. Everybody's comments have been so supportive. I just can't thank you enough. So, have a great day. Jackie Beyer here, signing off. Let's get growing.